the field, turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong.
Final furlong.
Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live.
HRRN Live.
It's Trainer Talk Wednesday. Now, here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is the show that trainers listen to, and we are going to have a great show on tap for you here this evening. We do welcome everybody just joining us across the country on Sirius Channel 93, and all of you who have been with us for the past 3 hours with our live racing coverage from Belmont Park from 3 to 6 on XM 209. Welcome back to the program, and really looking forward to Trainer Talk here tonight. JT, the first time you and I have had an opportunity to be back in the saddle again, so to speak, since that Preakness Stakes this past weekend at Pimlico, and our hats off to everybody at Pimlico for making that just an amazing event.
Well, you know, we love going to the Preakness, and this year was no exception. Had a great time at Pimlico. They roll out the red carpet for us, and just can't say enough nice things about everybody there. Mike Gathkin, the director of publicity, just, you know, fantastic guy, works really hard, and all the events surrounding Preakness were fantastic. Beautiful weather, wasn't too hot. It was really nice in our booth, little breeze, and then of course a great race on Saturday, and also the Black Eyed Susan, and both undercards were good. So it was a great weekend.
He is Jude Feld. I am Mike Penna, and we are joined on the first half of Trainer Talk tonight by trainer John Kimmel, nice enough to spend some time with us, the native of East Orange, New Jersey, who is closing in on 1,200 career winners. His runners have earned more than $54 million in purses, and John is with us now. John, we appreciate it. Thanks so much.
No problem, guys.
Yeah, welcome to the show. And you and I talked yesterday. It's been a bit of a soggy summer up in New York, or soggy spring, I should say, up there in New York. Get rid of that before the Belmont, will you?
Yeah, it would be nice to have a nice weekend of weather for Belmont weekend, but too bad that's not under our control. And in one place, the synthetic tracks seem to make the weather a non-issue, but these races are meant to be run on conventional dirt.
And John, I mentioned those numbers, nearly 1,200 career winners, $54 million plus in purse earnings from the horses that you've saddled over your career. What goes through your mind when I mention those numbers? Those are pretty impressive.
It makes me think I'm getting old. You know, when I first came on the as a trainer, I've always been involved in this business since a little kid. I grew up down the Jersey Shore, and my father was a fairly prominent owner who introduced me to the game when I was in my teen years. And we spent our summers down the Jersey Shore and used to go to Monmouth Park. And my first job actually was walking hots for a guy named Tommy Hurd, who trained for my dad and graduated to rubbing horses. And the only problem was all your buddies were going out and partying on the nights, on the summer nights, and you had to get up at 5 a.m. and make it to the track and to do your job, which was tough. So I guess after 3 summers of doing that, I got a job working for the veterinarian, Dr. Colando, which is a much more civilized job. I didn't have to show up till 8 o'clock. So actually I enjoyed that and ended up, during my college years, instead of being a business major, which is what I went in to start as, I went into pre-med and graduated from the University of Colorado in 1976 and got accepted to the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine, where I spent the next 4 years learning the practice of veterinary medicine. So, you know, I've kind of been around for a long time. But most of the early type of my career, I was practicing veterinary medicine for the first 8 years once I had graduated from vet school.
I got to give you credit, John, because most trainers, when Mike gives their stats and, you know, 64 million, 52 million, most of them say, where did all that money go? You were the first trainer, I think, in the history of Trainer Talk that wasn't wondering where the cash went. So you must have done okay for yourself.
Hey, it's a tough business to make a lot of money. And it's, you know, the only way, in my best estimation, to make decent money is you got to have a good horse, or you turn over a horse, or you sell a horse for a nice profit. That's really been, for me, the keys to my success, way beyond what we've earned in purse money. Is I've kind of made my reputation buying and developing young horses and selling them at the opportune time has been, for me, the key to my success from a financial standpoint.
Well, John, you talked about all of the, well, I guess the difficulties of this sport and how hard it can be, getting up every single morning, being at the barn at 5 a.m. And then, of course, you mentioned you went on to earn the pre-med undergraduate degree at the University of Colorado, went on to veterinary school at in Pennsylvania. What led you to want to get back into the training side of things and go down that road again?
You know, I guess what really had stimulated my appetite to get back into training, it was a tough decision because everybody says, you know, anybody can go get their trainer's license. And here I've spent 8 years in undergrad and graduate school attaining a veterinary degree. But what I found so interesting about training, and even when I was practicing veterinary medicine, I was involved with training horses and pinhooking horses in the two-year-old sales way back in the early 80s. So I just kind of felt that with my background that I maybe bring something to the table that most trainers couldn't bring to the table. Having the degree of knowledge about medicine and surgery and being able to diagnose and early injuries before they became career threatening, and just having a little more of that medical background might be a real aid and a big advantage over a lot of the competitors and actually a lot of the people that I was working for as a veterinarian. But the first 3 or 4 years were real tough. It was, nobody knew me, and the only horses that I trained were either my friends or myself. I owned a significant portion of the horses that I initially trained. It actually took me 3 or 4 years to get my dad to loosen up and give me a few horses to train.
Really?
And once I showed my talents, he was much, much more willing to give me some of the better horses that he had purchased and had raised as well.
Well, that's when you know things are tough, when you can't get your dad to give you a couple of horses.
Well, I know.
Yeah, but he started. He gave me a couple of the ones that Jimmy Toner didn't think could cut the mustard. And actually, I started down in Calder where I was practicing. That was the first place I took out my trainer's license in 1987 in Florida.
Second string for Caesar Kimmel, huh?
Yeah, that's what it was. Second string for Caesar Kimmel.
Yeah, that's
basically
tough.
Basically a true statement.
I've got some friends that have trained for their dads over the years. I only had one horse for my dad. He wasn't wealthy enough to have any horses, but they always gripe that their dads didn't pay their bill.
Well, I got to say one thing about Pop. He was, and he's still alive, and he's 86 years old now. He's kind of out of the business, but he was a great owner. I mean, he had been around, and we had a really good run of success. Once he gave me the freedom to buy some horses, we developed a bunch of nice grade one horses. I bought him fillies like Flat Fleet Feet and Fabulously Fast and Miss Golden Circle. You know, they all went on to be graded stake horses, and actually we had some pretty darn good success that he had really not experienced before.
Well, John, I grew up in Western Massachusetts, Pittsfield, just about an hour from Saratoga, so I followed you and your career in New York racing as a kid, and you mentioned the name Flat Fleet Feet, and that was one of my favorite fillies, and I can remember that Tom Durkin would always try to say the name extremely slow so it didn't trip him up. How did that name come about? Did you name her?
No, if you know my father and his history with names, it goes back 4 or 5 decades now of names that my dad, I think when he sat in his office there in Rockefeller Plaza at the Time Warner building, he spent half of that time concocting names. But he's always been known for his name, so he came up with this, a fleet filly, flat fleet feet. He thought Durkin would have a hard time trying to pronounce it. He was always trying to come up with a tongue twister that could throw the track announcers. But anyway, I said, Dad, this horse doesn't have flat feet. It doesn't matter. Let's just name this horse flat fleet feet. I said, okay. Well, anyway, she became a very nice filly, and she was a grade one winner. And actually, she was one of the first. So kind of a funny story. As I was starting my career and feeling confident to buy horses at the two-year-old market, I had followed this filly from the farms in Ocala down to the sale at Calder. And she had a funny-looking tendon that scared everybody, but she had kind of arrived from the farm as a yearling with it. And so I was one of the foolish ones to stick my hand up last, and I bought the horse for, I think, $30,000 or something. Then I said, God, I don't even have an owner for the horse. So that weekend, the half-brother wins the Holy Bull down there. So I went, wow, that was really lucky. This mare now has produced a grade three winner, and this is the second foal. I could make a profit here. So I called my dad and his partner. I said, you guys ought to buy this filly. I want $40,000 for the horse. So I said, okay, we'll take her. Well, anyway, she went on to win $740,000, $750,000, whatever it was, and they sold her in full for $2.3 million. I said, I guess I left a little on the table, and I'm not taking a piece of that one.
Well, that's a great story. Talk a little bit. A lot of people think, you know, a trainer goes to a sale, you know, flies in on the plane, shows up, goes out, sits there with a cocktail in hand and bids on horses. Talk about that process of going out and scouting horses at farms before they even go to the sale.
Well, you know, there are a lot of bloodstock agents that do their work, and then there's some people that go out there and, you know, maybe do less than their share of what you think would be the proper way to attract and quality horses. But you know, if you really want to spend the time going to the farms and maybe watching some of these horses, especially nowadays when, we'll talk about the two-year-old sales first, is when you go to these two-year-old sales, they only get one shot to breeze. And sometimes it might be a good breeze and not, and might be representative of what the consigner thought the horse would do, or it might not breeze that well and might not represent what the consigner thought the horse should do. Maybe it was a little green and didn't get off the pole right, for whatever reason, kind of looked around. And when you only have one shot at it, like they do now, there's only one breeze in the recorded sessions of these two-year-old sales, where there used to be two of them, if you go back 5 or 6 years ago. That's a very good angle. Sometimes you can buy a horse that maybe didn't do what they thought the horse should do, and as a consequence, you don't have to pay the kind of money that sometimes those top real quick breezers that perform better than expected end up bringing. So that's where some of your homework will come into play there, where you might not have to give the top dollar and get a horse that might be as good or equally better than one that did breeze faster. So but that's an interesting area, the purchasing process. I have kind of geared my summit. I have a partnership that we're now in our third year that I kind of pioneered called the Summit Thoroughbreds. And we geared our partnership to target the elite two-year-old sales graduates rather than buying into the yearling market. And the reason that I do that is because I think there's so much more added information you can get about a racehorse at that age than you can at just watching one walk around, looking at their pedigree page and looking at their physical presence. I mean, the information about their breathing ability, about how they move on the racetrack, about their ability to sustain and maintain their soundness when they're being asked to do significant levels of work are something that kind of points out those horses that might be biomechanically a little superior and they have what it takes to maintain racing soundness. There are many horses that fall prey and that look great as yearlings, that you get them out on the track and you start breaking them and you're watching them move and you go, God, that horse moves terrible. Or, you know, he doesn't move anything like I thought he would move. And that's the beauty of a two-year-old sale, where you get that added information. It really is information that's so valuable and relevant to their suitability as racehorses.
Trainer John Kimmel joining us on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. John, we talked about your dad, Caesar, and his prowess as a prominent owner, but your pedigree, so to speak, in racing goes back even a bit further than that to your grandfather, Manny, if I'm not mistaken.
That's true. You know, my pedigree goes back to Grandpa Manny Kimmel, who was a bookmaker before there was Prairie Mutual wagering. And stories, and I've seen the pictures of my father and him would drive up and rent a house on Union Avenue in the 30s, now this is. And my dad would say he was only 15, and it was a funny story. He got pulled over by the cop, and my grandfather was a kidder, just like his son is now. He said, yes, Caesar, show him your license. He didn't have a license, but I guess back then that was just kind of a funny thing. So anyway, getting back to the story, they rented a house on Union Avenue, and my father would drive his father, Manny Kimmel, to the track, drop him off, take the car over to the Giddy and Putnam, and he would hang out at the pool for the day and then come back and pick him up after the last race. And stories were related to me back then that he was a very good bookmaker. And, you know, it was something he used to tell me. He was so good with moving numbers and bets that he would make $2,000, $3,000 a day every day at Saratoga making book in the 30s, which was
wow.
Quite astounding to me. It was a lot of money back then.
Yeah, that was a whole different era, and of course the money was much more significant. It's kind of strange now that you can actually make dime bets, and in those days the minimum bet was $2, and $2 bought so much more.
Oh, yeah, it's, I don't know, 20, 30 times more. It's incredible what the inflation has been, but it was unbelievable, because the pictures I had seen, the grandstand at Saratoga was packed, guys wearing straw hats and, you know, from apron all the way into the stands, from one end of the stands to the other, full.
Wow.
It was such a popular sport even back then.
Well, John, I mentioned how I could remember Flat Fleet Feet so well. Let's talk about some of the other top horses you've had the privilege to be around and come through your program. One in particular that really stands out to me was Hidden Lake. What comes to mind when I mention her name?
Hidden Lake, she was a really, really top race mare. Unfortunately, she didn't like California very much. And she had shipped to the East Coast to run down at Keeneland. And she ran a credible race down there, whether it was the Madison, I don't really remember. But at the time, I was training for Robert Clay, and Robert Clay bought the horse. And another guy that got to be pretty big in the game, it was his first horse, named Tracy Farmer. They asked me to take the filly. I brought her into New York, and at the time I had Mike Smith was riding First Call for me, and I had this filly named Flat Fleet Feet. And the first race we were going to target, when we thought she would like these big turns and one turn races, was the SHU-V. And this was a SHU-V at Belmont. And I said, Mike, I just got this new filly, and I'm going to run her, named Hidden Lake. And I got Flat Fleet Feet. I'm going to run them both in the race. Who do you want to ride? Oh, I'm going to ride Flat Fleet Feet. So at that time, Richard Migliore's agent and I were becoming pretty good friends. And he was trying to get in the barn. I said, okay, you want to ride this filly Hidden Lake? Sure. So anyway, the story just kind of goes from there. And Hidden Lake won the SHU-V. She come back and she won the Hempstead, the Gopher One, the Beldane, and you know, she had won all those races in succession and beating all the best fillies in the country and running big numbers. Back then, I think her buyer numbers were like 115. Pretty good figures. And we decided to take a shot and run her in the race out there in California where the Breeders' Cup was at Hollywood Park. And we were so excited about it because she kind of stood head and shoulders over the field. But it's Richie Migliore said as soon as she broke, and he could feel right away, she didn't care for those California surfaces. And God, it was a multi-tequila shot night that night. I was so disappointed. Anyway, that's horse racing for you. But she went on, and she actually got voted the Eclipse Award filly, even though she failed in the Breeders' Cup distaff that year.
Well, those type of events where you get so excited to run a horse and then they just don't perform. I mean, you saw that over the weekend with Shug. I mean, most people thought Orb was a foregone conclusion, and it really, really takes a lot to get over that sometimes. But, you know, you always have a smile on your face and a pretty good attitude, so it probably doesn't take you as long to recover as it does some people.
Well, you know, it, like Shug said, you know, the lows are way outnumber the highs, and I'm sure Shug, it's like a good gut punch. And for whatever reason, he didn't run his A race. You know, I don't really know, but he just looked kind of flat that day, and I kind of think might be more involved with the surface of the track. It just seemed so deep and cuppy, and they weren't putting any water on it, and when they run three-quarter fractions in 13, it just seemed like it was not the type of track that was conducive to his running style.
John Kimmel, our special guest on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. John, who are some of the other horses, when you look back on your career, that are really going to stand out to you?
Well, I always had one of the greatest stories. There was a horse that I bought at the two-year-old sale for me. And it just kind of shows you the genesis of highs and lows in the game. Was a horse named Premium Tap. Premium Tap was a son of Pleasant Tap. And I had paid a whopping $60,000 for him at the Ocala sale. And I started searching around for somebody to own him, which it didn't take that long. But three fellas from the Jupiter area in Florida where I live, each took a third of them for $20,000. We bring him to New York, and it takes him a few starts, but by his third start, he was a fairly dominating performance and got the calls, and somebody wanted to give us $650,000 for him. So kind of thinking about this, and we think he's going to be a nice older horse by Pleasant Tap. He's got a pedigree that shouts three-year-old and going to be better going longer. So we decided to pass on the offer. And as we went down to Florida and tried him out in the winter, he just didn't seem to do very well. We ran him a couple times, and he just didn't look right behind, and sent him to the farm and had a nuclear scan, and he had some non-adaptive bone issues, and then he started back again and had a suspensory, and now it kind of takes us all away again another 9 months, and we're saying, God darn, we should have taken that $650,000. So you're kind of kicking yourself. And well, anyway, as he came into his four-year-old career, he showed up with a big win at Belmont and beat Sun King. And then into the summer months, he runs in the Whitney and runs a decent race, but kind of needed the race, and comes back, wins the Woodward. And now he's grade one winner. And we took him down to Turfway for that nice classic race. The Turfway Classic was like a $350,000 race.
Yeah.
It was kind of a bad trip. Kent almost got him, DeSormo rode him, almost got him dropped. And we didn't know whether or not he would cycle back in enough to run back in the Breeders' Cup Classic. But we decided to go, and we had to put up the $100,000 because he was not eligible. and he ran third in that race, which we got our money back, and Invisor wins it. Bernardini was second. We come back to Churchill 3 weeks later, and he runs a commanding performance, winning the Clark, which was a grade one at that time, and he wins by 8 or 10 lengths in a super fast figure, and the phones start ringing, and Sheikh Mo wants to buy him, and the King of Saudi Arabia wants to buy him, and I'm like volleying back and forth. Well, $5 million. Yeah. Well, the King of Saudi Arabia just offered me 5.2. So he comes back. Well, how about 5.5 for Sheikh Mo? So Saudi Arabian manager said, I just got offered 5.5 from Sheikh Mo. Well, how about 5.7? So at $5.7 million, I sold the horse to the King of Saudi Arabia, and the horse came with a stipulation that he wanted me to bring the horse to run him in his race in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, called the King's Cup. I said, King, I'll come run that horse wherever you want if you give me $5.7 million for that horse. So it's a funny story. So we go to Saudi Arabia, and now the horse hasn't run now since Thanksgiving weekend. So here we are now in February, and this race is on it's like a wood chip racetrack, and it's at 1.5 miles. We never ran farther than 1.25 miles. So we end up getting delayed getting there. We leave Gulfstream, go to Belmont, and fly out of Kennedy, we don't get out of Kennedy till like Tuesday. He gets there Wednesday for race Friday night. Now, and he hasn't run. So we get into the paddock. I got the jock. We've flown, however long, 18 hours to get there with a jock, myself. We come into the paddock to saddle the horse, and the manager's on the phone, and he says, that's the King of Saudi Arabia. I says, what does he want? The King says he doesn't want to run the horse. He wants you to scratch him if he's not going to win. I said, holy God, are you kidding? We just flew here, and I don't know who's in the race. I don't even know who these horses are. He said, but we came this far. We're running. And, the horse commanded the field and just drew off and won for fun. And everybody was running around having a great time, and we got to meet the King. And it was like one of those surreal situations. And he followed that up 6 weeks later with a second to Invisor in the World Cup in Dubai. And like I say, he was a lot of fun. He was a handful because he always had little quirks about him. But that was one of the more enjoyable progressions and from purchase to sale that in my career.
John, that is such an amazing story, and I can't thank you enough for being here with us tonight. Jude and I have thoroughly enjoyed talking with you. We're just kind of bummed out that it's over. We could have gone on for another half an hour easily. It's been great, and hopefully you'll join us back again up the road.
Well, thanks, guys. We're working hard at trying to get our barn up and running. I think we got a lot of nice young horses in here, so hopefully we can kind of get ourselves back in the limelight, and you can see us in some of these big weekend races here in the future.
We'll look forward to seeing you at Belmont in a few weeks.
Thanks, John.
All right, guys. All right, take care. Have a good day.
All right, John Kimmel, our special guest here on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Wow, what an unbelievable story.
Yeah, he sounds like he's had a lot of fun in his career.
All right, we're going to be back with the second half of Trainer Talk right after this, so stay with us here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is Trainer Talk, the show the trainers listen to. What do the last three Kentucky Derby winners have in common? Animal Kingdom, I'll Have Another, and now 2013 Derby champion Orb have been separated from the pack with the help of Pala Mountains Equine Pro. Internationally patented and formulated in pristine New Zealand, the equine products are scientifically designed to allow a greater conversion of energy and help correct the nutritional imbalance that some animals struggle with. All in one daily nutritional supplement that gives you the results you need when it matters most. PalaMountains.net. That's P-A-L-A. Mountains.net. Remarkable products, remarkable results. I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta from Flair Equine Nasal Strips. One of the hot button topics that's out there now is EIPH. Talk to me about that.
Mike, EIPH is an acronym for exercise-induced pulmonary hemorrhage, or what is commonly referred to as bleeding. When exercising at high intensity, some of these horses can hemorrhage a little bit into their lungs. Flare strips have been shown to reduce that bleeding and keep these horses healthy and their lungs healthy during performance.
To learn more about keeping your horse healthy, visit flarestrips.com. That's flarestrips.com.
Attention horsemen, are you getting the most out of your equine athlete? All natural EPO Equine could be the answer. EPO Equine is the most potent blood builder on the market. Top trainers like Scott Lake and Steve Margolis are reporting dramatic improvements in their horses. Easy to use and clinically tested, EPO Equine is the product your horses need for speed, strength, and stamina right out of the gate. Call 215-501-6880 or visit epoequine.com.
It's Trainer Talk Wednesday on the Final Furlong on HRRN Live.
Mike Penna back with you on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Welcome back to Trainer Talk here on HRRN. This is the show trainers listen to, and we are joined by a good one for the second half of the program tonight. Charlie Lopresti is a native of Brooklyn, New York, and he may be best known for conditioning multiple Eclipse winner and Horse of the Year Wise Dan, and he's had so many other memorable moments throughout his career that we're going to talk to him about here tonight. Charlie, thanks so much for taking the time, and welcome to Trainer Talk.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I mentioned Horse of the Year Wise Dan. It's been a pretty special run for you.
Yeah, it's been pretty special. He's been a really, really good horse. I mean, every day I'm around him, I think about how lucky I am to be around the horse like that. He's a lot of fun.
Well, I mentioned you're a native of Brooklyn, and a lot of people in this game hail from that part of the country, in particular Brooklyn itself. I know a lot of people in the game are from that very same area. Talk about, kind of take us back to the beginning and talk about growing up in Brooklyn and how you got hooked on horse racing.
Well, when I was a young kid, I always liked horses. My uncle had carriage horses, and I always was fortunate enough to be around to ride them and help them with the driving and things like that. And then I started going out on the East End of Long Island. I was involved in the show horse business. I worked at a show horse barn, but I always felt like I picked up a Blood Horse magazine one day, and I was kind of reading about the race horses, and I thought I'd really like to get into that. And I went to a farm in Virginia, and there was an ad for a job. And when I got there, the job was taken. But they told me about their trainer at Belmont, Joe Canny, at that time. And they hooked me up with him, and I went up there to work for Joe. And that was around the time he had Cox's Ridge and some of those horses. And it just kind of got me hooked.
What do you remember about that first time when we walked into Joe's barn and you said, "Hey, I'm here for a job. What do I do?" What do you remember about that day?
Oh, you know, it was pretty overwhelming. I walked in that barn, and, you know, I'd never been to Belmont Park. It took me a while, I remember, to find this barn. And when I got there, I walked down that shed row and saw all those horses and all the exercise riders and grooms and all the things that were going on. And it was pretty overwhelming to me. But I knew I liked it, and it was pretty scary at first, to be honest with you. I wanted to do everything right.
Do you remember the first time that, as a kid growing up, you got a chance to, was it Belmont Park? Was that the first track you would have gone to?
Yep, that was the very first racetrack, you know, the very first job I ever had.
Wow, that's amazing. And so you go to work for Joe. Talk about that. Talk about being part of his operation and being around so many of those outstanding horses.
You know, he and Charles were married at that time, and it was a pretty good operation. Joe was a very, very good horseman. Everything was real meticulous in the barn. It was all about the horse, with a lot of attention to detail. His horses always looked the best. I can remember him telling me when we'd lead one to the paddock, he'd say, "Boy, we might not outrun him, but we're going to sure outlook him." And, you know, he was just really particular about that kind of atmosphere, you know, the way the horses looked, the way they were presented, the way they were taken care of. I mean, he was a real, real horseman, and I learned a lot. He was very particular about everything you did. Everything had to be perfect.
What are some of the things I guess maybe that would be one of them. But what are some of those things that you took from Joe that you still incorporate into your operation today?
Well, you know, one thing I liked about Joe, he was a hands-on horseman. He'd ride his pony to the track every day. He was right there with the horses, and that's what I liked about him. Treated them all as individuals, and took the time to make sure that they behaved and did things properly, and just his attention to detail, just about the way bandages were put on and the way rundowns were put on, and make sure that bridles were adjusted properly in a horse's mouth. And there was just a lot of attention to detail, and he was pretty hard on you. I mean, he kind of drilled that in you to be that way. And if you made just one little mistake, he was right there to always correct it. And I think, you know, his attention to detail really, I think I've tried to take that with me to my barn.
Yeah, it sounds like a great person to learn from, though.
Yeah, he was, you know, he was really good. I mean, he was great with legs. And one thing about him, he was very good about getting in the horse's mind. I mean, he could really work with – Cox's Ridge wasn't an easy horse. You know, he was a big, strong, tough horse, I remember. And just a lot of his fillies, you know, and he really did a lot of work with him. And he was just a really good horseman. You know, there's a lot of horse trainers out there. But I think there's very few true horsemen anymore. And he was one that was a real horseman. You know, he rode jumpers and, he was a good one.
Yeah, well said. And we started off by mentioning the name Wise Dan, and we'll talk plenty about Wise Dan as we move throughout the next 20 minutes or so, Charlie. But looking back at Joe's operation, you mentioned Cox's Ridge. Who are some of the other horses that really stand out to you when you think about the outstanding individuals that you had a chance to be around?
At Joe's barn or just
at Joe's? At Joe's.
Oh, you know, Cox's Ridge was a good one. He had that filly, Miss Baja. I had Temperance Hill. I was around Temperance Hill, in the early stages, and then I had gone to Kentucky. But that Cox's Ridge, he was a tough handicap horse, and I remember we dealt with quarter cracks, and there's a lot of leg work with him, and he's probably the one that stands out the most. And that filly, Miss Baja, she was a nice filly as well.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, didn't you spend some time here in Lexington at Domino Stud as well?
Well, that's how I went to work for Ted Carr. I was with Joe, and I really wanted to do more than just be a groom and a hot walker. I really wanted to learn to gallop horses and see everything about the racehorse business. I was so enthralled with the racehorse business, and he really wanted me to stay there. But I wanted to go to the farms in Lexington, and I wanted to see about how they broke the yearlings and how they raised the babies and just everything about the business. I wanted so much to learn about everything in the business, and I thought there was more that I could learn than just being on the racetrack. So he set me up with Ted Carr Domino Stud, because at that time they used to keep all Loblolly's babies. They used to break all the Loblolly babies, and they broke all the Green Tree babies. And so I went to work for Ted, and there's probably another horseman that stands out in my mind that I've learned a lot from. You know, he made me do everything. I mean, I broke babies. I went to the breeding shed. I had to go back and foal mares at night. I had to be teasing mares. I had to be around the sale prep. But that's what I wanted. I wanted to learn everything that I could about this business and about horsemanship. So it makes you a better rounded horseman.
Yeah, I can imagine it has to help out tremendously now with your operation, because you are very hands-on. You don't have the big stables of, say, a Todd Pletcher, a Steve Asmus, and those type of numbers. But I think from talking to you in the past, you really don't want those kind of numbers. You're a hands-on horseman.
Yeah, you know, those guys, I tell you what, Todd amazes me. You know, I was talking to him right before Wise Dan ran. We were at a party together one night, and his attention to detail and the way he can handle that, it amazes me. He's, you know, I wouldn't say that I don't want to be like those guys. I just don't think that I could handle that many horses and be as attentive to it. You know, I would rather have horses in one barn where I can see them all the time. And, I could go to Saratoga with a half a dozen or something like that. But I think it would be more than I wanted to handle. We have, you know, a couple of hundred head or whatever those guys have. But my hat's off to him, because he does a great job at what he has, I can tell you.
Now, how many horses do you have as part of your operation now?
We've got 30 there at Keeneland, and I probably have, oh, I don't know, 20 or so at my farm. And that's enough.
Talk about the farm. Forest Lane Farm here in Lexington. How did that come about? When did you start the farm, and what led you down that road?
Well, you know, I was working for when Ted left Domino. He went on to manage a couple of the farms. But anyway, he went to Mr. Paulson in the 80s, and I went to work for him as an assistant manager at Mr. Paulson's farm in the 80s. And that was just another, probably not, you didn't ask about this, but that was an incredible operation. I mean, I was around the beginnings and the end of that, from building it from day one. And, you know, we were around, I mean, I was fortunate enough to be around like horses like Cigar and Arazi, and wow. I can go on and on. But I wanted to, we had an opportunity to start our own operation, and I talked to Ted about it. And so we went on to start our Forest Lane Farm, and I just, you know, started with a couple of horses and just wanted it. We started breaking some yearlings and doing layups, and it just grew from there. You know, it grew from there, and then I had an opportunity to start training horses, it's been a long process, but it's been a good one.
And you had the relationship with Calumet too, right?
Well, I did. When just about the time we got Forest Lane going pretty well, I don't know, we had a half a dozen or so horses. Neil Howard was a friend of mine. He's the manager at Gainesway right now, but he got the job as general manager at Calumet. And you know, he had all that training operation over there when he took over Defiakowski's horses. And Neil called me and said, you know, I really need to get somebody to come out here that would, you know, help with this and do the breaking and training. And I said, well, you know, we've got a farm going. He said, well, I don't mind you to, you know, keep that going. And Amy can do that if you'd want to come over and talk to us. So I did, and I took that job. I thought it was a wonderful opportunity to have a racetrack right at my hands there and have my farm to do. Then I got to bring in some horses that were further along from my farm to Calumet to further them, and that's where I met Bob Lewis. I had a horse for Bob Lewis, and he actually is the first person that gave me a horse to train at the track, and that's why I took my trainer's license out. I ran a horse off of a Calumet farm for Mr. and Mrs. Lewis, and it won, and then Mr. Defiakowski saw that, and he said, why don't we give him some horses to train? And before you know it, I had a stable of 15 horses in training and a bunch of young horses getting ready for Bill Mott and Lucas and those guys that is well trained for Calumet. I had my farm running at the same time.
Well, who was the first horse that Mr. Lewis gave you? Do you remember the horse?
I sure do. His name was Competitive Edge, and he beat a horse that Bill Mott had for Calumet. It was an allowance race, actually, and Mr. Fiekowski saw that. And he said, well, we need to give him some of our horses to train as well. But I remember that horse. He's the horse that started my whole career. That's why I took out a trainer's license to run that horse for Bob and Beverly Lewis.
Charlie Lopresti, our special guest on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, and a fascinating story as to how he got into the business. We'll fast forward in a few moments to Wise Dan and some of the outstanding horses he's had the pleasure of being around in more recent memory. But I want to let our listeners know, Charlie, when you're not at the racetrack, you're a big fan of team roping, if I'm not mistaken. Are you still involved with that?
Well, you know... Yeah, I do like to rope, but I just don't have the time to do it like I used to. Matter of fact, I've got a really nice mare that we sent off to a trainer, and she's been shown, and I'd like to rope on her some, but I gave her to a buddy of mine. He's been taking her to shows, and I haven't even had time to do it. Dr. Steve Alday is a big team roper, and he's invited me to his place I don't know how many times now, but I just don't get the time to do it as much. More than anything, I kind of like to, when I get a little time, I'll do some fishing or some bird shooting or something like that. But I don't have the time to travel around and team rope like I'd like to.
All right. And your wife, Amy, involved intimately in your operation. She handles a lot of the breaking and training of the yearlings. Talk about Amy and what she is. First of all, how did you meet her?
Well, I met her at Domino Stud when I was working for Ted Carr. I was living there on the farm, and she was working with the mares and yearlings, and we just met there, and we've been together ever since.
That's an amazing team. Talk about what she's meant to you and to everything that you know, they say behind every man is a good woman, and you have a good one there with Amy.
Well, yeah, she works very hard, you know. I mean, she comes to the barn with me, and, you know, I'm on the pony watching those horses go, but she sees a lot of things from up in the grandstand, and you know, she works a lot with the horses too, and she does the farm stuff and is involved with the breaking. And we have some people come from out west that help us from Nevada and Oregon. And usually when I'm at Saratoga, she and those guys from Oregon and Nevada, they get the baby started. And she's very involved with Dr. Bramlich and all the layups and stuff that go on to surgeries. That's a big thing that she does. I mean, she's really good at, you know, like with Successful Dan, all the injuries that he's had, paying attention to that, coordinating all that with Dr. Bramlich. And, you know, she is a very big part of our operation. And I've got a real good team of riders and the girl that runs my barn, Cheryl. And I mean, I can go on and on. We've got a really good team. A lot of the grooms have been with us for, I don't know, you know, maybe 8-10 years. You know, it's just, it's in the riders, it's just been really good.
Well, Charlie, you and your team have so many different ties to this year's Preakness Stakes. When you look back at 1999 Horse of the Year Charismatic being raised on your farm, right? Or at least a graduate of Forest Lane Farm. And then, of course, that was the last Preakness winner that Dwayne Lucas had before this year when he returns with a Calumet runner. What was that like for you seeing Wayne back in the winner's circle and seeing Calumet back in the winner's circle?
Well, I tell you, that was really neat. You talk about charismatic. We had him at our farm till he was a two-year-old, and then he went out to Westerly where Wayne was, and he went into Wayne's program. It was really neat to see. You know, Wayne Lucas is just an amazing, amazing man. You know, there's a lot of controversy around him, but I tell you one thing. When it comes to Mr. Lewis, used to always tell me, when it came to those Saturday afternoon races, you can count on Wayne to be there, and don't ever count him out. And the older I get and the more I realize how hard it is to do this, he just simply amazes me. I mean, that horse ran a beautiful race that day. It was kind of neat to see, and it's really neat to see Calumet coming back.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. And Wayne said during the Preakness week and the days leading up to the race that he said, you know, we do have 3 of the 9 runners in here, he said, but if we're going to play this game, we're going to be in a full court press. We're not playing any zone. And being a former basketball coach, he could throw those terms around, and he certainly wasn't a full court press in this year's Preakness.
Yeah, you know, I was really glad for him. And it's funny, the morning that Wise Dan ran in the Breeders' Cup, I met Wayne down in the lobby, the hotel. He was having breakfast when I was having breakfast. And I said, I don't know, Wayne. He goes, don't worry. He said, you're in good shape. He said, I've watched that horse train for the last couple of days. He said, nobody's going to beat you. And I thought, well, coming from Wayne Lucas, that means a lot. And we won that race. And I saw him, I don't know, a week later. He said, I told you nobody was going to beat that horse. He said, you brought that horse in as good a shape as I've ever seen a horse come to the Breeders' Cup. So it kind of made me feel good that he said that. I mean, you know, he's a great horseman, and he's done so much for this game. And it's so great to see him whenever he comes back and has a horse like that, you know?
Well, Charlie, let's talk about your horse of the year, Wise Dan. Take me back to the beginning with him and tell me his story.
Well, you know, I always knew that he had talent. I mean, he was a very talented horse, but he could be tough at times, you know? I mean, not in a mean way, but he was just always an overachiever and always did more than I really wanted him to do. And now, and looking back on it, I just, you know, now I realize how much talent that horse had. You know, everything that he did was so easy. You know, if you asked him to gallop a mile and a half, well, he just would go, you know, 14 to the furlong, and you're like, you don't want to go that fast. But now, the more I'm around him, the more I realize how much better, how much of a superior horse is to most of any of the horses that I've had. I mean, he's just superior to. He just does things that are amazing to me. And every time he works or every time he runs, it's like, wow, what, you know, how much better can he get?
You can really tell early on that the horse has something. Like, I talk about that it factor a lot. You could tell that he had that something special about him?
Yes, he's one of them. I mean, I've had a lot of horses over the years and been around a lot of horses that I thought had a lot of talent. And then for one reason or another, whether they weren't sound or mentally they couldn't deal with it, or they couldn't put it together in the afternoon. But he's one that has done everything. I mean, I shouldn't say this, but it's a dream come true. He's sound as he could be. I mean, I don't have many problems with that horse. And every time you lead him over there, even if he gets beat, he's going to run. I mean, in the Stephen Foster last year, he got beat ahead. I don't think he handled that track at all. He didn't have the best trip, but he still ran. And there were some races that were he didn't win, but it weren't terrible races. It wasn't like he just, you know, threw a clunker in and you're scratching your head and go, man, why did he beat one or two or something like that? He always gives you a thrill when he comes to running.
And I'm going to put you on the spot just a little bit. What would be your favorite Wise Dan moment, whether it's on the track, off the track, but that favorite moment that you've had with your horse of the year?
I would say the Breeders' Cup. You know, we missed the year before with Turlo. I was really disappointed, and to come back and win the Breeders' Cup with Wise Dan, that was probably my favorite race, you know, and then realizing that he broke the 15-year-old track record. And, you know, there was a lot of hype about Frankel, you know, and Wise Dan and the horses that he had been running against, and Acceleration coming, horse ran second to Frankel, you know. I was a little worried when I got out there. Well, I'm going to find out how good he is today, because there was so much hype on Frankel and that the horse, you know, Acceleration, and then Animal Kingdom. You know, I thought he was going to have to run the race of his life, and I was proud of him because he did run the race of his life that day.
Yeah, and I've heard several trainers mention that their horses really become like their children, and I can imagine with a small operation like yours that it's probably even more so for you, is it?
Yeah, you know, he's pretty special. I guess you remember we were at that farm manager meeting and Graham talking about, you know, having to walk away from Animal Kingdom one day. And it really hit me, you know, that day. I could see the look on Graham's face that, you know, he's going to have to turn the shank over to somebody and never maybe see him again or never be around him like he used to be. And that's not going to be the case with Wise Dan. I think he'll come to our farm and he'll always have a home because he's a gelding. But he is pretty special to us, and as long as he continues to run the way he runs, we're going to keep him going, you know, and he is like one of our children. I mean, he's just been a dream come true. I hate to keep bragging about him, but I don't know what else to say.
No, you have a right to brag about him. He's pretty special. You also mentioned the name Successful Dan, and a lot of people familiar with him, maybe not as familiar as with Wise Dan, but tell me the story of Successful Dan, because that's a really neat story too.
Well, he's got a lot of talent. You know, you look at his race record, it speaks for itself. He's been plagued with suspensory injuries, soft tissue injuries all of his career, and had that not happened, I mean, I he's equally as talented as Wise Dan. You could look at his races, you could look at the horses that he's run against, the horses that he's beat. He's a good one too, and right now he's doing really good. We brought him back in the Ben Ollie, and he won that race, and we're looking to run him in the Stephen Foster right now, and you know, he's doing really good. But he's a day-to-day horse, you know. Like I said, Wise Dan's a dream come true. You always have to worry about soundness. I mean, not worry about soundness issues with him. And Successful Dan, about the time you get him ready for a big one, there's something else goes wrong. But right now he's good, and we're going to hope he keeps going that way.
Yeah, and I can imagine, Charlie, it probably has to be as rewarding for you, maybe more so on some levels, to have a horse like Successful Dan overcome so many different things and then win a big race after all of those things that he's had to go through.
Well, it is, and he does it every time. If you look at him last year, he won the allowance race at Keeneland, then he came back and he won the Ali Sheba, and he beat Fort Larned, Mucha Macha Man, and then we took him to Saratoga, and we were ready to get him ready for the Whitney, and then he's had the ligament injury flare up again, so we had to stop on him. But it is very gratifying when he does come the right way, and he's another one, when you bring him over, he's going to run. The day that he doesn't run is the day that he needs to be retired, because he's a great racehorse as well.
Outside of your two Dans, Wise Dan and Successful Dan, who are some of the other horses that really stand out to you when you look back over the past several years of your career?
Oh, you know, Here Comes Ben. That was my first grade one winner. I went to Saratoga with him and ran him in the four-go. He was on a three-win winning streak at that point. We took him up there, and he won the grade one four-go. I mean, that's probably a horse that'll always be true to my heart. I've got a mare that's in foal to him right now. He was my first grade one winner, and he went to the Breeders' Cup Mile as one of the favorites in the Breeders' Cup Mile, and it didn't unfold for us. And then Tourlore. Tourlore is another horse that we're desperately trying to get back on track. I hope we get him on track. he won the Woodbine Mile for us, and then he was second beating ahead in the, well, he won the Bernard Baruch at Saratoga, and then he was second beating ahead in the Breeders' Cup Mile, just missed.
I'm not sure that was ahead, was it? Was it that far?
I don't know. It wasn't that far, but I thought it, actually it was so close that we thought we won it until we went through the tunnel and we watched the slow-mo, and then I said, oh, no, I'm not sure we got there or not.
How difficult was it to get over that defeat?
Well, you know, it was difficult, but, you know, that's part of the game, you know. I mean, it's always difficult. I mean, but we got over it, you know. Life goes on. He came back good, and we got him back again. So maybe hopefully we can get him back on track again.
How about a horse or two that really kind of you'll always hold a kind of in a special place in your heart that maybe some people haven't heard of? It kind of an under the radar type of horse that you've had the chance to be around over the years, whether it was coming up working with Joe Canty or maybe other people or maybe yourself.
Oh, you know, charismatic. Charismatic, well, you guys know about him, but I mean, he lived in a field right behind our house, and we always liked him. You know, he was just a beautiful mover and a nice horse and a big, strong horse. And what you think about a Triple Crown horse ought to be big bone, just, you know, big kind of secretariat looking kind of horse. That's kind of the way he was. I mean, he's won, and that horse Competitive Edge that I, the first winner that I had, you know, he was kind of a special horse, too. I mean, he had problems, and we took some chips out of his ankle, and he was kind of a head case. He wasn't the easiest one to deal with. You'd go to races, and you'd have to hold him because he'd fret and walk the stall. But, you know, he's one that got my whole career going. I mean, he won, I don't know, 180,000 or whatever it was, and some of that was before I got him. But he was the horse that got my career going. I mean, there'll always be a special place about him, too.
Well, Charlie, just a few minutes left here before we wrap this up. Time flies when we're having fun. This has been a really enjoyable visit, and hearing your story is just amazing. I usually like to end the Trainer Talk interviews by asking trainers what they do when they're not at the racetrack, but you mentioned you love to fish, you love to bird hunt when you get an opportunity to do it. First of all, what type of fish do you typically go after, and where is your favorite place to fish?
Well, my favorite place to fish is at Saratoga, the Battenkill River. I like to fly fish for trout up there. Unfortunately, when I go up there in August, that's the worst time because the water's at its lowest point. But it's fun to do that. Just when I get done at the barn feeding at the afternoon, you know, I make sure the horses are okay and go home and get my fishing rod, and I'll just go up there till dark, you know, and then get home and then get ready for the next morning for the track. And my bird shooting, I got an English setter puppy. She's a little bit over a year old now, and I've been working with her. And a lab puppy, and I like to do that in the winter with them. When my downtime with the horses, I'm always up there at, you know, in County Kentucky, working with her and training her and bird hunting with her.
Harder training the horses or training the labs?
I don't know. That lad's pretty tough. He's got a hard head, I'll tell you. You know, I just like training. That's what I like about, like, the team rope. And, you know, sometimes I'll just go down here and get on one of my roping horses. I don't do it much anymore, but I just go ride them out through my farm. And it's enjoyable for me to do that. Horsemanship is what I like, and I just like fooling with them and trying to get them to do different things. And, it, you know, I guess I'm a trainer at heart, whether I have a dog, a roping horse, or a racehorse. That's what Amy said. Can't you just go ride and enjoy yourself? Why you got to train something all the time?
Well, Charlie, look, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to be with us here on Trainer Talk. I've been really dying to catch up with you and hear your story for a long time, and I'm sure our listeners have really enjoyed it. Thank you so much, and I'm going to look forward to seeing you out there at Keeneland and maybe over at Churchill this summer in some of the big races.
Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed you guys. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it, Charlie. Charlie Leprestri, our special guest here on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Ben, just an amazing show here and a really fun interview with Charlie to hear his story, hear how he came up through the ranks and some of the things that he had to overcome throughout his training career, and to see him here with a horse like Wise Dan and Successful Dan. You heard him say Tour Allure, another horse he's looking to get back on track as well. Great stuff. And who knew? Fly fisherman, lab trainer, he does it all. Our thanks to Charlie Leprestri for joining us here. To John Kimmel as well for joining us in the first half of the show.
Really appreciate him being here. Great story there. If you missed any portion of the show, you can go back to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check it all out. On our site, the Trainer Talk tab on the right-hand side of the page will take you there. Charlie and John Kimmel. All right, we're back tomorrow, 3 to 7 Eastern time on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Make sure you join us. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on HRN.